I don't think I'm open-minded to everything, because I think I'm a strong believer of opportunity costs. So I try and focus on what we're doing, and I don't let anything in the door. Like going back to those things that we draw up for the business. Like I don't pivot. I don't try anything. Like it's a long sustained plan. It's step by step. It's grow. You know. And but yeah, the ways to achieve something is very sort of lateral. Like the end game might be linear and might be direct or whatever, the direction we're going, but how you get there is
like a swervy road. I'm lucky to have on the show today Richard Fitzgerald, who is the founder and CEO of Augustus Media, with brands like Love in Dubai, Love in Saudi. I think that you said there's 16 or 17 Lovins now. Thanks for taking the time to be on the show.
Thank you, Tarek. It's a pleasure to be on.
I know typically you're in my seat interviewing other people. You also have your own podcast, Dubai Works. So I'm super excited to get the chance to turn the spotlight on you today.
No problem. And we actually interviewed maybe 2 years ago now the co-founder of Bezat as well on Dubai Works. So it's good to appear in other people's shows.
Yeah. Just from our conversation together, you've kind of had a whirlwind career, and I'd love to just kind of hit on briefly, you know, how you ended up founding Augustus Media.
Yeah, Love in Dubai. I think I started out in advertising digital agencies in Dublin, where I studied, and I'm from the southeast coast of Ireland, and I started my working career in 2006, and you know, but people say about advertising, it's a service industry, it can be quite tough, and not that it's a young person's game, but there's a lot of young people in it, and they kind of say after 10 years, you know, you either set up your own agency and things like that. And as I was approaching the 10 years, I realized that you didn't have to leave it. Like, if you liked the industry, and you could become more senior in different areas and stay in the industry. So, but this was in my mind as I was going through what was a career in Dublin and London and in Dubai in 2012, and working across different countries with about six or seven different agencies, you know, always kind of part of that social media rise. You know, like, I remember doing social media for Coca-Cola in Ireland as an added value because I was so passionate about it. And this was 2007. We were running campaigns on Bebo and Facebook, and I was setting up Twitter accounts and doing competitions before Coca-Cola had global social media guidelines, you know. And you know, Ireland wasn't quite ready to have an agency, so I joined a big social media agency in London, and then that led into media agencies. And my entry point into the Middle East was amazing and brilliant, because I joined a network agency run by, you know, the pioneers of the advertising industry in the Middle East, which were, you know, people from Lebanon and people who moved to Dubai and people who set up these network agencies. And that was amazing for me, because I was able to, I was regional head of social media. I had access to clients across the region. In 3 years, from 2012 to 2015, I pretty much visited every country in a working capacity in the region, set up a social media department in Beirut, and it was an eye-opener, really. But I always thought that I was ambitious, right? And I always thought that I wanted to have my own agency. And it ended up being this. So this isn't an agency, right? Like, this is like, it's a difference between client side and agency. You know, publishing is on the other side, you know, and you do have to kind of flip your head over the other side and sort of get used to it, because it's journalism, it's broadcasting. And but I was a bit, Tarek, I was a bit restless about 2015. I'd just been back from Beirut, and I sort of, on the way back on the flight, I had to let someone go, and I was kind of like, you know, doing the same thing for about 3 years, which I'm not bored now after eight years of doing Love in Dubai, but it was just sort of one of those things of kind of like, you know, I'm ready to be an MD. And I pitched out to a partner that we were working with on it was actually kind of AI bot technology back then, and I pitched his startup. I told him I could be your MD, and I did. And that summer I also saw what a friend of mine was doing with Love in Dublin, and I kind of said, well, I want to do that too. And I signed a 10-year area developer agreement. And, you know, because of the nice way that the regulation happens here, I did an NOC with my current employer, but in Astrolabs, and I know you had Mekki on recently. Yeah. You know, so we started out there in 2015, and you know, again, just through a good network in Dubai, they led us in, and also the chairman, Ahmed bin Salem, was happy to have a publisher in there, even though DMCC didn't necessarily have the right licenses. You know, as we've matured, we've got sort of MRO at Media Regulatory Office and National Media Council, and we've kind of graduated out of that now. We have studios now in Production City, but back then it was sort of a publishing type tech company, media company. And, you know, I saw the traction it was getting in early days in September 2015. And but 6 months in, I was kind of like, okay, I'm a bit stressed out. You know, I kind of left not a comfortable, but a really well-paid job. And I took a pay cut to join a startup. I was kind of I had some equity in it. And then I'd set up my own business.
Yeah.
I hired expensive editors from ITP and this type of thing.
Yeah.
Not necessarily mistakes, but definitely things that like...
You can call them mistakes on this show.
Yeah, you kind of do what you think you have to do to run it. And then you learn different ways along the way.
Yeah.
To kind of answer the question, it was like I thought I wanted to set up a social media agency.
Yeah.
And I would always have restless nights over the years. Mm. I don't have restless nights now. Yeah. Like, you know, like I'm doing what I kind of want to do. But I had kind of like anxiety of like, oh, I should be doing more. Mm. And I thought it would be a real-time agency. I love this idea of like social media being agile and reactive. And now essentially Love in Dubai is a real-time agency. Like when something breaks, we're on it, but we're doing it for ourselves with no client approval, which is amazing. there's strict media guidelines, but there's no client approval. But then we sort of found ways to monetize and kind of built from there. I can tell the rest of the story, but that was the sort of the
inception.
Even I would meet people in Dubai over those early years and say, oh, this person's interesting. Why don't I sit with him and her and set up an agency together? You know, people kind of think you need a co-founder in advertising to take some of the pressure off, or someone who's good at pitching, someone who's good at operations, someone who's good at business development, or, you know, like in tech, you might need an idea and a CTO or whatever, or, you know, two people. Yeah. And I was looking for that for many years. I was just watching a video of Pep Guardiola this morning on TikTok. A manager, and he said he knew when he was 26 that he wanted to be a manager, right? And like I knew early days I wanted to be a media type or an agency type entrepreneur. I knew quite early, so it was kind of finding the way into it. Mm. I didn't necessarily know that this would be the path. I didn't know that it would be kind of a franchise, a publishing business, but it sort of all makes sense now in hindsight.
Sometimes the pieces of the puzzle just kind of have to fall right in. And the path we think is the one that's going to get us to the final destination isn't the actual path. And I'm a huge believer of just having a North Star and then just being flexible around how you get there. So I think your story reiterates that. It seems like there was that, I guess even before that, it'd be great just for anyone who doesn't know what Love in Dubai is, it'd be great just to talk about kind of the Augustus Media, let's call it an empire, and some of the stats that support how massive of a business you've built in the media space.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's nice of you to say, but I think it's relatively big in that it's kind of hard to build a media business in this day and age. Yeah. You know, there are some sort of impressive numbers, but essentially Love in Dubai is a local news and lifestyle platform. It in itself has got a lot of reach. You know, there is some months over the years where we've had 3 million page views in a city of 2 million people. Overall, we had 1 billion video views last year. There's 70 employees across the region. We're profitable every year since 2017, including during the pandemic. The engagement across channels, I think it's not, you know, there's times where people would have thought Love in Dubai was like a website or a Facebook page, and now they think Instagram is really popular. But we always had that approach of being digital. So we've got the Love in Dubai morning show, we've got podcasts, we do things with influencers, we've a really big email database, we've WhatsApp, we've all these different things, and so that's essentially Love in Dubai. We position Augustus Media as a modern media company, and that was the mission target. Like back then in 2015, 2016, I wrote down to be the modern media company of choice in the Middle East and North Africa. Like getting inspiration from other, like Bob Iger, Ride of a Lifetime, the CEO of Disney, you know, we sort of borrowed his vision in 2005 for what Disney would be. And there's three things. So we say we want to be a digital first company, and we say we want to be a Middle East, a truly, truly pan-Arab, Middle East, North Africa company. And we want to be, we want to tell our own IP and our own stories. So those things direct all the decisions, right? Digital means we don't do events. Digital means we don't sort of do talent management. We don't do, people have ideas of Love in Dubai over the years and they say, you should have a pop-up store, you should do a burger, you should do, no, digital. Or you should do a magazine, or you should do a radio station because it'd give you more clout. No, digital, like. And then Middle East and North Africa, right, there have been publishing businesses in Dubai, right, 15, 20 years before us. None of them, we were 6 years, 5 years ahead of them in Saudi Arabia. We were the first, and through Astrobs, we were the first foreign-owned media company, 100% foreign-owned in 2017 in Saudi Arabia, right? Which is amazing in a country that Riyadh didn't have a printing press until 1953.
Yeah.
Just mind-blowing, right? Yeah. And so, you know, and so in every country that we're in now, whether it's Khartoum or Karachi or Beirut or Doha or Bahrain or Oman or Cairo, like Muscat, we have a journalist on the ground with the love and lens, the love in your lifestyle. So so we really are pan-Arab. And, you know, I had a chance to sort of set up Mumbai, South Africa, Singapore, buy out Love in Dublin and things like that. And I didn't. Like, literally, the license IP assignment is for this region. And so it's really focused on that. And then, you know, even digital, you know, it's not just social.
Like, yeah.
We've spent a lot of money, a lot of time getting streaming right, because streaming is an essential part of digital media. Mm. Like, we're building our own OTT with Smashy TV, Smashy Sports. And I'm not giving up on that, because it remains conviction of that sort of mission. And then the third part is our own IP, our own stories. And at the moment, it's non-scripted. Yeah. But sure, that can be documentaries, that can be movies in the future. But that helps us not sort of fall into the easy money, not easy money, but sort of the tempting thing, the fixed retainers of agency model, which was my comfort zone in the past. And we've had to take some of that early doors to sort of keep revenue going. But, you know, that's Augustus Media. It's text, audio and video. It's a slash between a broadcaster and a publisher in terms of licenses. And, you know, that sort of thing of building you know, empire seems to be kind of a grandiose word and statement, right? And sure, monopolies in media isn't as possible anymore, and nor should it be. And that's not the sort of point of what we're trying to achieve. But we do want to build a media company that works across the region where others outside of the region have never done, right? Like News Corp, Rupert Murdoch, people like that, they never entered the region. And the ones in the region did it brilliantly in their own countries, but didn't necessarily do it across other countries. Like NBC is the closest, but even they had sort of issues in some countries and things like that.
How important is it to write down, you know, company principles? It seems like you have a lot of clarity around the three things that drive the vision and the DNA of the company.
It helps me. I don't know how important it is for every entrepreneur.
Yeah. I guess for you, how did you go through the process of defining what those were and tweaking them along the way if needed?
Yeah, I mean, there's plenty of kind of three things, you know, there's four things, there's plenty of things, but definitely the mission statement was there. There's a vision, which is established in new order of media advertising that could be bigger and global, but that mission, that point of what we're on this journey trying to achieve. And then, you know, the strategy to achieve that is just to help those decisions. We've got values, like in those agencies and companies I used to work with, the ones that had better culture, they didn't write down what the culture was, but the ones that had, that people felt more belonging in, kind of knew what their values were. And, you know, we've got tenacity, ingenuity and velocity, and we have values champions each month, and we get people to encourage spotting those behavior types, and each of those values have 8 or 9 behavior types underneath them. So writing all those things down help. And then, you know, the definitely writing things down help, but I think your question around how you iterate and you kind of change and adapt things, it's simpler to do with corporate structure and ownership, right? You know, when we had we put about $140,000-$160,000 in 2015, 2016, myself, my brother, and two other people. And they, between them and not me, they have 25% of the business. And when we were sort of going out of, when we were buying Lovin' fully, and when we were doing other things, and when we were moving licenses in Dubai, and when we were setting up Abu Dhabi Global Market, and when we were entering Saudi, I had to decide whether they come with me or not. And of course, when they saw the expansion and everything, they were kind of like, oh, Rich, we invested in you, not Lovin' Dubai. And so, right, because they wanted to sort of have Augustus and Odeon, yeah, or Content Studio, and they wanted to have Smashy. So I had to decide whether to kind of let them or not, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, and that was sort of writing things down and figuring things out. But figuring out that structure in the same way, that iterative process of sort of going, okay, this is our structure. We don't necessarily believe in raising a lot of money. And luckily we haven't right now with media companies like us that did on tech valuations sort of in the middle of the last decade. They struggle now. And Tariq, I think I learned that from, you know, the startup that I was in after the sort of WPP companies. They raised a lot of money. And when I was there for a few months, I saw it didn't sit comfortable with me having a burn rate and knowing the economics around business. Like, I studied economics and knowing that in university, but knowing the economics around business and agencies, I was running a business unit in previous roles, and I knew the FTE model, I knew the margins, and it just didn't sit comfortable with me. So we never entered into conversations around high valuations, and all those things helped decides who owns what and what the future is, and even it decides now. So I have a lot of clarity around the sort of mission. I also have a lot of clarity around perspective, other people coming in, and, you know, I do want to list the company, but it can take 10, 20, 30, 40 years. Mm-hmm. I do want to do M&A. I do want to do many other things, but we're in a building phase at the moment.
Yeah. It seems like you had a little bit of, I'll use the word impatience, although I don't mean it in a negative connotation. Before starting Augustus, it seemed like you just kind of, you know, had this agitation, this anxiety to start something. Where do you think that came from?
I don't know. Like, I've obviously, you know, I've been asked the question before in different podcasts, and you know, I ask of myself, where does the drive come from? And you can get philosophical about it, and you can talk about upbringing and motivations and things like that. And, you know, I could give long answers of my parents and my upbringing and, you know, where I come in the family and all that sort of stuff. But, you know, to put it simply, there's drive there. You know, there's drive, there's discipline, there's ambition. And, you know, it was apparent to me for a long time.
Mm.
And that impatience, not necessarily anxiety, but that drive is still very much there.
Yeah. And how do you sustain that? And, you know, I say sometimes that being an entrepreneur is being in a marathon, but one where you have to sprint the whole way. So how do you sustain that? What are some of the things you do to be able to sustain that?
Well, marathons, I do triathlons and Ironman and things like that. So I do believe in that endurance. You know, philosophy on life is similar to the company. It is about longevity. It is about sort of, you know, thinking that I would like to run this when I'm 90 years old. And when you have that sort of long-term view, but then you live every day with enthusiasm and excitement. And I still have the same energy and patience all the time. It's easy to sustain it. Like, it's my character. It's my nature.
Yeah. And how do you avoid the flip side of that, which is kind of burnout, maybe getting clouded in headspace? And I think for me personally, when I've been in a long stretch and haven't had a chance to take a break, I find that my judgment starts to get a bit more cloudy. And so what do you do to try to avoid that state?
Yeah, definitely. I would relate to what you've said on many occasions. I embrace it.
Mm.
I accept it and embrace it. And everyone finds their own way of coping and dealing with things. I think knowledge and learning compounds, just like investment, just like fitness. And I think when there is sort of cloudy moments, and cloudy moments can come from feeling down and burnt out. It can feel from you know, type of depression. It can feel like heated times where you're dealing with conflict, and conflict can be with individuals, it can be with internal, external, it can be with money, it can be with many things. And there's times where the weight of the world, it can be with editorial things, with legal things, right? Like dealing with that heavy burden, but I embrace it. And I don't want to say this in a way that, you know, but I don't take breaks. And a friend of mine is asking me about this at the moment, and they said that, oh, they took a break, they watched the game and things like that. And I just had to reflect on that. And I don't, like, I do read every tweet. I don't ever want to be complacent. And I'm just consciously, like, aware of it. You know, I had a good coach at one time about emotional intelligence, and I consumed a lot of material and books on that. And I'm not bulletproof. There's definitely times, you know, as recently as January, where there was a conflict moment where, you know, it does weigh on you. But having been through that in 10 years of agencies, and been through that with bosses, and having restless nights and employees and tension and things like that, you definitely get the hang of it. And you not that you can get any better at it. You, it's always there, but you're kind of like, it'll pass, but also it will pass by taking action and fitness and exercise. And, you know, what are great people from the past, you know, from history and things like that, and great people from the present, and leaders, and people in many walks of life, how do they deal with it? Are they human? Are they impacted when there's negativity online about them, when there's things like that? So one way I think about it is that you can have influence and be influential even when you're not at your best. And it's about showing up, and it's about knowing that you're not at the best, but sort of operating at a kind of 5 out of 10. Like even sports people, right? Like they play the game, they get the job done, and they find a way with experience and stamina and resilience and delegating and sort of communicating, and they get the job done. So I think that answers it. I don't take a break. I don't run from something. I know I'm coming in. I know I've got this burden of stress or whatever, and I will still find a way at a slower pace to navigate it, and to instigate it, and to create momentum, or to ask for help, or to do things like that.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of, to your point, it's kind of like being the gym, right? I think showing up matters a lot, just by the nature of being there, the virtue of being there. It's already a win. And I think conflicts and tough times are definitely similar. You talked about getting an emotional intelligence coach. I'd love to get your perspective on what the experience like was, how the experience was having a coach. How would you advise people to find a coach, and why is it necessary at certain periods?
Yeah, I think the last bit you said, I think that's exactly how I would think about it. It's necessary at certain periods, and just embrace it. Like the times that I've spoken to people, whether it's a work-related coach, career advice, or a therapist over the years, haven't been that many, but I think three specific occasions for a brief period for a few months, they were the solution that was needed at that time to get through that phase. But I think it's just having that mindset about learning and improving all the time. Like the gym compounds, and why do we go to gym? Well, we should go to the gym to fight diseases. Like that's why we should do it, for muscle and for mental health. Like that's really the only point. And the same with, you know, why do we talk to people? It's for clarity, right? It's for clarity and sort of, for different reasons like that. I found I called her emotional intelligence coach, but actually it came at a time where we were doing team building, and, it was a kind of a career coach business, and we were doing team building, and, you know, I was quite aware that we were doing a lot of performance reviews for employees, and I wasn't getting a performance review. And so it was during the pandemic, so I asked for a 360, and she led it with clients, with internal and with external feedback on me. And, some of the things, like always, right? But some of the things you don't like hearing, or you do like hearing, and that in itself was a good process. But on the back of that, because she was quite good at what she does, the advice was, you know, to work on these areas, here's your homework. And, you know, I forget the name of the book, but it's like, I'm using my hands, like it's quite a big book.
Yeah.
And it's one of those theoretical things. Like I did 1 year of psychology in university because I thought that would help me with like working with people. But then I realized it's just reading citations from some studies of 20 people in the 50s or whatever, right? Yeah. It's quite boring and learning off.
Yeah.
And this was that book was about, but it was, and there was about three books, but this was one just particularly on emotional intelligence, and it just really helped me.
Yeah.
Maybe it was the right place at the right time.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how I kind of view it.
Yeah. It seems like you also just are very open to trying new things, opening new doors, and it kind of, you know, for lack of a better word, excites you, turns you on, whatever you want to call it. How do you, for people who don't have that, I guess it can be daunting, it can create anxiety, it can be fear. So what drives you to be excited by new things? How do you advise people who have a little bit of a fear factor behind risk, per se, address that?
Yeah, I think, you know, some of the values, again, like ingenuity is about being open-minded and, you know, like this sort of proactive approach to things, like growth mindset versus fixed mindset. I don't think I'm open-minded to everything because I think, I'm a strong believer of opportunity costs. So I try and focus on what we're doing, and I don't let anything in the door. Like going back to those things that we draw up for the business. Like I don't pivot. I don't try anything. Like it's a long sustained plan. It's step by step. It's grow. You know. And but yeah, the ways to achieve something is very sort of lateral. Like the end game might be linear and might be direct or whatever. The direction we're going, but how you get there is
like a swervy road. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's the same with ideas. Like that's the same with embracing things. There's, you know, how do we market entry? Like we're entering into sort of Levant, Shams region now, or you know, those different countries there. And how are we entering there? We did a costing exercise for Beirut, for Lebanon in 2018. It's very different now. And, you know, how are we entering all these places? And, you know, some of the people I work with on the different departments on the product or the finance or the operations, they're very sort of... what's the word, analytical, and they're very sort of but that's not what you said, or that's how we did it different, you know. And it's kind of like, but the only way to do that is the way that you taught me before. And I'm kind of like, you know, out of just to get them to just to mess up the sort of step-by-step sort of plan, I sort of throw in curveballs, and I'm kind of like, because you need to think, you need to sort of be solution orientated, and you need to sort of know that there's 50 ways to do these things, especially with media.
Yeah. And I think that's the, you know, with experience, with time, I think I've realized that how to make decisions, what decision feels like more of the right decision, you start to become much quicker at having that feel of this is the path we need to take. And sometimes it's difficult to kind of explain it. And sometimes what trips me out is, how do I make sure that I have that, let's call it instinct, I have the benefit of experience. How do I pass that down to the team that works with me to make sure that they're able to develop that muscle, that decision-making muscle? And so that's something I spend a lot of time thinking about as well.
That's an important thing. Yeah, I can learn from that.
You said something interesting, and I've kind of been debating this with our executive team at the company. So you said you read every tweet. And I heard something recently on another podcast. There was a founder who said, any CEO or founder who tells you they're not in the details is full of shit, or they're unsuccessful. And that stuck with me because I think as the company grows, as the scope of oversight grows, there's this idea of delegation. There's this idea of maybe you have to move a little bit further back from the details. But I find myself that in some areas, in some scope, I'm very in the details. And just when you said you read every tweet, that kind of triggered that thought. So how do you think about that balance of detail, delegation, being close to what's happening on the ground versus empowering?
Yeah. Well, I wouldn't say versus, like, but I think you can do both.
Okay.
And that's what I try and do.
Can you elaborate?
Because business, you know, but what is business? Like, how can you run a business if you don't know the business?
Yeah.
How can you run a successful restaurant if you don't know it? If you're not running it, if you're a holding group and your investment group, you need operators.
Yeah.
You need people who run it. Warren Buffett built a collection of businesses, and he always believed in the manager. Like the guy, when he did media, the guys that he got to, they were radio stations or whatever, and then they bought ABC, a big network, and then Disney bought them. But there's many examples of him believing in the manager. But he knew he wasn't a manager. He was brilliant at reading books, so you have to know your strengths. But I totally agree on the CEO thing and running the business. And, you know, sleeves always rolled up, always in the weeds, always in the trenches. That's my approach to it. But I'm consciously doing it because I believe that it's needed. If you're a team player, if you're a captain on the pitch, or if you're a coach, you need to be involved. Like, if something's missing, then if you're a captain on the pitch, then you need to drop back and fill the gap. If you're a coach, you need to spot that. But you can do both. Depending on where your role is, and depending on the stage of the company, there's a difference between being in, for us, an MD of, say, a Dubai office or an Egypt office or a Riyadh office or a Saudi office is different to being sort of a CEO. And I have to consciously know the difference. Like sometimes this style can come across, like when you're really in the detail, and when you said sort of versus there, like, yeah, sometimes it can be micromanaging and there can be opportunity cost to it. But I totally agree with that statement from before, though, the podcast that you mentioned, that, you know, when I look across, when I interview people on Dubai Works or other CEOs, you know, you're not successful unless you really know the business, like unless you're really in it, you know, and you can be in it in different ways. You can be in it by knowing enough of the detail to put the right person in. But how are you going to know if they're the right person if you don't know the detail of what they're doing? Like, there's many examples, you know, this debate and this conversation always feels like it's one of the
either or, yeah.
But it doesn't have to be. And, like, you know, you hear great leaders, like, what is leadership? What's the differences of management? And, you know, I've seen loads of quotes on this and loads of books and loads of things like that. And, you know, one example is that if you're a CEO and you're running really, really fast, and others can't catch up, then that's not good. You should slow down and let them run fast. And, like, all different analogies and things like that. But, you know, at the stage of our business and the style that we're at, the way that I can have impact is about being on it. But I'm here on a Friday morning at 9:40, yeah. And there's people across the region working. There was a show that we did today. Like, if I couldn't delegate, I wouldn't have 70 employees. Yeah. Like, we wouldn't have been able to go from $1 million of revenue to 2 to 3 to 4 to 5 to 6 to 7. Mm-hmm. Like, we wouldn't be able to without that.
Yeah.
So that's why it's not really an either or.
Yeah. And the way I rationalize it as well in my head is, you kind of hit on it. You really have to know the details to know what good looks like, and then to be able to hire for that job, sure. Right? The second way I rationalize it is, in specific areas, you need to be at the forefront because that area defines the future of the business. And then bringing people along to support, if I'm in the details, I can actually coach them along the way. So the way I look at it is, you know, I can actually, by being in the details, I can better coach, I can better develop to the point where they are fully empowered, fully capable of running that initiative, running that geography, whatever it is.
That's well said. And yeah, you know, going back to our values in terms of velocity, which is basically about momentum, and it's you put momentum into one project to get it momentum, but you have to drop the others because your energy and your resources are there. And I totally agree, if you need to initiate or lead a new project or steer it or find the right people, then your focus is there, and then you back off.
Yeah.
And then you let that run once it's a bit smooth, but you don't take your eye completely off the ball.
Yeah.
I was, when we were setting up Smashy as a streaming service that 3-4 years later we're still hacking away at, I remember being in New York in Gary Vaynerchuk, VaynerMedia's offices, and I asked him this question because he always talks about being in the trenches and in the weeds. And I said, how do you have 7 offices and 7 different businesses? Like, if you're someone who has anxiety, if they're not in the weeds or in the trenches, how do you do it? And he said, you write the rules. It's your pace. And that was really interesting for me. But he said, well, obviously, you know, if he's launching a wine company or if he's launching a sneaker brand or an NFT project, you know, that might need energy and momentum at that time. But if he's not in it, you know, 80 hours a week, whatever he talks about, or, you know, if he's not in it all the time for 12 months, he's, you know, has the awareness enough to know that that's not going to move fast enough as the other. But then he moves the dial, he moves the time frame of his expectations of where it should be. You know, like, my expectations of where Smashy should be now isn't controlled by we didn't take $10 million of investment and say we're going to have 1 million subscribers. Therefore, I'm in control of the timeline around it. And therefore, I'm in control of the expectations and the pressure. But of course, the only way to make Smashy grow is by being in the trenches and being in the weeds, about giving it the same energy as I've given Love in Dubai. And I will at the right time, in the right time frame.
And Velocity's come up a few times. It's an idea. I mean, today Bezat's about 300 employees. So my co-founders and I are super paranoid about speed and velocity as the business is scaled. And you've mentioned it a couple of times in today's discussion. I'd love to get your philosophy around speed, velocity. You've touched on it. How do you find the balance between being extremely aggressive and not being so aggressive in terms of speed and time that it sets an unrealistic expectation?
Yeah, I think it's many factors, right? Yeah. Business planning, many factors, growth projections, targets, communication, many things like that, but also being realistic, right? You know, there was a time sort of end of last year, early this year, where we were looking at ESOP, employee share options scheme. And, you know, it was a time where we were going to be giving bonuses, and there was a thought that they might be more motivated if we give shares. And then it was like, okay, if we do, we grew 2022 versus 2021, we grew 60% with a 40% target. This year we have 40% target. If you keep compounding that to 2030, we'll be $100 million revenue business. And we pulled back from it because, first of all, the employees achieved the 40, 60% growth without shares, first of all. And then secondly, if we switch to the share model versus bonuses, so if we put every bit of capital and dividends, then the shareholders would get restless and need that liquidity before 2030. The employees would need cash because they can't do their down payments and things like that, or whatever they want to spend their bonuses on if we were doing that. So I kind of gave them the option, and obviously they wanted both. Obviously they wanted both, but I think what I did, Tarek, is kind of went, well, there's only a handful, you know, there's only, we're ambitious, but why is it 2030, like, or whatever? Like, why is it 40% every year? There's the Intelligent Investor book goes through the history of, you know, S&P companies and FTSE 500 companies, and no one grows at 40% year over year for 20 years, ever, right? Ever. So that's the thing, right? So it's, again, it goes back to sort of momentum. It goes back to compounding knowledge and educating. So why would I, you know, why would I pitch a story, right? Like, we've seen startup founders who sell a dream, right? And then are their personality leaders. Yeah, but what's the, where are they long-term? So, you know, and if they learn, they can kind of tell a different story at different phases. So, you know, like you and like what you've built in the story of other companies, I would always be always be aggressive in mindset, but just be rational about the implementation of that aggression.
Yeah. That's the tough balance. You mentioned something and stuck out, that you said in every city, every Lovin has a journalist on the ground. How do you maintain the right attitudes, the right culture, the right feel, brand, all of that, in countries or places where you have a one person show?
Almost impossible, but we try.
Thanks, that makes me feel good.
But we try. Look, like even the software that you guys provide and things like that, like there's things that we explore, but it's not just one solution.
Yeah.
There's that culture thing. You know, when we were entering Pakistan, Pakistan wasn't part of our plan. Technically, it wasn't sort of Middle East and North Africa Arabic speaking. So we said, oh, that's not Augustus then. We'll just do that as a partnership. It'll be Love and PK or whatever. We'll do Lahore, Karachi, Islamabad. And we let one guy run it, right? And it failed badly. Like, and in the end, because we went through the legal aspect of an incorporate JV rather than just a license, we'd actually done a lot of the investment and we were left with a choice. Okay, so he was departing. We then thought, will we find another him or will we continue the incorporation and just get more of the equity? And that's what we did. So now we will have Augustus Pakistan, which was never the plan. But for me, that's the vehicle to answer your question. The Augustus culture, process and operations. Like I always say we're a content company, but we're kind of an operations company in terms of operating media on the ground, having an in-house counsel in our office in Egypt, having things that enable us to operate, having tax people in different countries. Like, you know, that's going to be a key strength of ours as media evolves, because at the moment it's loving and smashy, but once we sort of feel that they're at a strong enough point, then acquisitions and mergers and allowing in the creator space of bringing creators under that umbrella. Like what do creators, YouTubers and people like that kind of need as they grow, as they become media companies? They will need that sort of ecosystem that we have, and not to represent them, but like, so when it's failing, so when it's not working, like for years, the Saudi office didn't really work.
Yeah.
For the last 2 years, it's been some headaches in Egypt. But having that sort of view of like, you know, yes, everything needs to be localized. Like in those countries, we only hire people from those countries and things like that. And we adapt and sometimes the business model adapts. But there are certain things that we believe in, going back to the values and going back to that service business and that consistency in the work that we do. There's certain things that we, you know, we let people who come into the business at a leadership level implement their ideas. And then when they don't work, we go, well, these are our ideas. And then, you know, there's a kind of a bit of a compromise.
Yeah.
But, it, you know, like anything with lots of employees, you know, but the beauty of business is that it's been done before, right? Like, look at the tech companies, 5, 10, 15, 20, hundreds of thousands of employees. Mm-hmm. Like, it, you know, what we're doing isn't impossible.
Yeah, yeah. My perception of media is that there's a large part of it is art, but from our conversations, it's clear to me that you're very analytical. So how do you think about the balance of, or the composition of art and science or art and math and building what you're building?
Yeah, I remember when I was getting career advice, when I was studying economics and I kind of wanted to get into advertising. And, you know, one person told me about artists ending up in advertising agencies because it's the kind of capitalism approach to creativity and it can kind of give them steady income. And I always reflect on the question that you kind of observed on that sort of that intersects between commerce and creativity. And that's very much, you know, it's both. Maybe on this chat, I've spoken more about the sort of commerce and operations and analytical side. But only because I've kind of taught myself it. But inherently, I'm more on the creative side. And even the style and the packaging of media is all about art. It's all about creativity. You know, we did a post on Love in Dubai yesterday that got like 17,000 likes and many shares. And I saw the same story on a well-known news organization. And I had like 100 likes. And I was kind of like, the only difference here is the packaging and the delivery and the consistency over time. It's the same story, but it's that sort of like emotion that you sort of put into that storytelling. And, you know, it's form and function, isn't it? You know, I always forget which one is which, but like there's, you know, form is the design and the things like that. And function is the sort of utility and you know, the form and the design and the creativity is absolutely important. But if you don't match that with function and if you don't match that with consistency, like how do you design a good podcast? How do you have that structure? You can have an amazing conversation, but if you don't produce it in the right way, if you don't distribute it in the right way, if you don't have the right audio and the right sort of system around it, it'll get lost.
Yeah, know, can that be taught, this idea of packaging form, function, or is it more you're either a creative person or you're not?
It goes back to the last question about how do you manage journalists in other markets. Yeah. I fully believe it can be taught.
Yeah.
I have mentors and other people in the industry who don't. There's many creative people who edit their own videos and who can never sort of scale in their own way. There's many creators who don't, but I have to believe because I can't build what I want to build if it's not possible. But it can be taught to a degree. Like it's like sport, right? Like, you know, you can have the vision of the style of play or the style of performance, and people can implement it in their own way. So it goes back to that sort of hands-on approach as well and hands-off. Like the packaging can be taught, but the way to teach it isn't to say do step, step, step. The way to teach it, which is why ingenuity is our value, is to teach them to think. So right now, there's a style of publishing that works. Okay, do that. But no, watch how it changes and watch the other ones. And when it changes, do that. And when it changes, do that constantly.
Mm. So the kind of first principles being taught versus the instructions. It's not an instruction manual. It's a way of thinking.
Yeah.
I've heard you say a couple of things on the show today. I heard you talk about kind of how knowledge and learning compound, this idea that showing up matters, even when you're not feeling your best. We talked a lot about running the business and being in the business and in the weeds, even as the company scales. And the concept of finding mentors and coaches at the right time when you need them is critical to your own learning and success. So I've learned a ton from listening to you on the show. I already told you before the show started, I'm going to show up at your office to pick your brain further. I appreciate you being so generous with your time.
Thanks, Sarik. It's really nice to be on it and keep up this podcast. As I said, there's a good few guests that you've already had on that, you know, people, they're really doing amazing things in the region, and your podcast is a good outlet for people to learn from them.
Awesome. I just added another great guest. So thanks for being on the show.
Thank you.